Our scripture this morning comes from the Gospel of St. Luke, chapter 8, beginning with verse 26. They sailed to the region of the Gerasenes, which is across the lake from Galilee. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the impure spirit to come out of the man. Many times it had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under the guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" "Legion," he replied, because many demons had gone into him, and they begged Jesus repeatedly not to order them to go into the abyss. A large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. The demons begged Jesus to let them go into the pigs, and he gave them permission. When the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When those tending the pigs saw what had happened, they ran off and reported this to the town and countryside, and the people went out to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. Then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them, because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and left. The man from whom the demons had gone out begged to go with him, but Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return home and tell how much God has done for you." So the man went away and told all over town how much Jesus had done for him. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Good morning. In the past, I've mentioned a film called The Last Wave. It's a film from the 1970s. It's a little bit low on production value, but the film is essentially about a man who's an attorney in Sydney, and he gets roped into a large murder trial where five Aborigines men have been accused. And it's the kind of film where the more he gets involved with the investigation and the more he looks into the case, the more strange things start to happen. This man starts to suffer these terrible nightmares, as well as his young son, who's like the age of 12. They're both having these terrible nightmares as they're in the midst of looking into this case. And so they'll see in the nightmares like torrential downpours or strange Aboriginal rituals. In one particular dream, the lawyer, the father, he even sees one of the accused Aborigines men kind of speaking to him. And there's all these apocalyptic signs of tsunamis and all these kind of weird things happening. And it's becoming increasingly disturbing, both for the man and for his little boy. And the boy keeps waking up in the night, and he'll go rushing into the bedroom and wake up his dad, and the dad will say, "Hey, you've just had a bad dream. You need to go back to sleep." Well, the more these events start happening, and the more the dreams are happening, and the more they're kind of starting to take shape in actual reality of their lives, that answer is becoming less and less satisfaction. You know, it's just a dream. Go back to bed. And so the father, the attorney, goes back to his father, who you find out in the film was actually a minister. And he says, "Dad, when I was a little boy and I'd have these scary dreams, I'd always rush into your bedroom and you just brush them aside." And then this is the question that I think is so poignant in the film. The man says to his father, "Why didn't you tell me that there were mysteries? You stood in that church and you explained them away." You know, a lot of us struggle with the mysteries of life. We've kind of live in a world, in a way, devoid a little bit of mystery. And sometimes church itself and pastors themselves can be the ones who not simply introduce the grand mysteries, but actually seem to remove them or seem to minimize them in some way. You may remember the scholar and professor at Columbia University named Andrew Del Banco. Prolific author, he's a humanities professor, and he wrote a well-known book, I think it was like in the 80s, called The Death of Satan. And in this book, he says, it's really surprising because the 20th century is by far and away the most bloody century on record. More genocides, World War I, World War II, more crimes against humanity, more famines, more natural disasters, more deaths of despair, like more terror, more horribleness. And he says, in a century in which you would expect that Satan would walk out onto the world stage and take a bow for all that he's done, instead, Satan walks out onto the stage and performs a vanishing act and disappears, and no one believes in him anymore. He then cites from the book, The Silence of the Lambs, a scene. If you remember The Silence of the Lambs with Hannibal Lecter, he cites this scene where Officer Starling is going for an interview with Hannibal Lecter, and she's trying to think in her mind, how does such a monster get made? You know, what's the origins of this man? What happened to this man to make him such a despicable, violent person? And she's wondering, was it his upbringing? Is it his biology? Like, is it his physiology? Is it mental health? Is it environmental conditions? And she's exploring these things. And there's a powerful moment when Hannibal Lecter says to her, "Nothing happened to me. I happened. You can't reduce me to a set of influences. You've given up good and evil for behaviorism, Officer Starling. You've got everybody in moral dignity pants. Nothing is ever anybody's fault. Look at me, Officer Starling. Can you stand to say that I am evil?" And Andrew Del Banco says, the problem with modern people is we have no answer to the monster's question. In other words, we've given up on categories of good and evil. We've given up on any kind of sacred order. We no longer possess the language and the metaphysics to be able to describe the horrors and the evils we see. And what's so powerful about this passage that we're going to look at is Jesus goes right in to the very realm of the evil. Jesus has an encounter with a man who would probably make Hannibal Lecter even cower in a corner, a man with many demons, a man with a legion of demons, a man who no society could contain, who broke his chain and lived among the tombs and roamed about cutting himself and shouting and screaming. And Jesus has this encounter with dark, evil, demonic powers. And we're going to see from this, where does Jesus go with his power? What does Jesus employ his power into? What directs his power? We're going to see what's the extent of the power of Jesus? And then ultimately, what's the aim? What's the end of his power? What's he trying to bring about through his use of power? So what's amazing about this passage is where Jesus goes with his power. He goes literally into a storm. So the passage just preceding this begins in verse 22, where Jesus says to his disciples, "Let us go over to the other side of the lake." So Jesus, it's his idea. He gets the disciples to go in a boat to leave the western shore of Galilee and cross to the other side, the eastern shore of Galilee. And they go into this lake, the Lake of Galilee, and there's this incredible squall. There's like a hurricane. There's a massive storm. And even these really experienced sailors, they're totally freaking out. Like they're bailing out water. They're rowing as hard as they can. They're begging Jesus to wake up. He's in some kind of strange supernatural nap. And they're begging him to wake up so they don't die. I mean, these very experienced soldiers are at the absolute end of their ability. And so then they finally get to the other side of the sea. So he leads them into this storm. Remember, it was his idea. And they get to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and they step onto the shore. What they would have seen in this region of the eastern coast of Galilee is they would have seen these sheer cliff faces. So it's this real sheer cliffs, and with these steep hills. And on the hills, they would have seen thousands of pigs. Now remember, Jesus said, "Let us go to the other side." See, the other side was stock phrase, if you're a Jewish person of that time, it was stock phrase for the other side of the tracks, like the place where the other lives, the dark side, like the chaotic side. They would just use it as a little phrase like, oh, ta peron, like the other side. You know, that's where the other side lives. That's where Romans lived. That's where soldiers would retire and they live in the Decapolis. That's where they worshiped other gods. That's where the pigs were. I mean, Israelites, they didn't eat pigs. So to step onto the shore and see thousands of pigs grazing on the grass, it's like, well, friends, we're not home anymore, are we? We're clearly on the other side. And to make matters worse, like, then they get off the boat and hear out of one of the tombs, and these tombs could be kind of, they were kind of carved into the mountainside, comes rushing this crazed man, naked, running down the steep slope for them. And you get more detail in Mark's account, how he's rushing towards them in the boat. Remember, they've just been through a storm. Remember, this was Jesus's idea. And here comes this crazed man shouting and screaming, and he's got a legion of demons. What is your name? He says, Legion. Legion is, well, he's only got, roughly speaking, 5,000 to 6,000 demons, give or take a few hundred, right? So this is a guy with major problems rushing towards them, and it was all part of Jesus's plan. So where does the power of Jesus go? Like, this is what you're going to see as you read these gospel stories. He's going to go constantly to the other side. He's always going to the other side. I mean, literally, he's going to the other side in this account, but then he goes to the other side into Zacchaeus' home, who's a tax collector, and the other side to a woman with bleeding who needs to be cured, who's unclean, and the other side of a home where there's someone who's dead in the home. And he's constantly going to the last place, the most chaotic, the most despairing. See, remember, friends, where does God first appear in the scripture? What is the first appearance of God in our world? Can you think of when it was? It's in the creation account. But it's not on day 7. God is first appearing in creation on day 1. And where is he? He's hovering over the darkness. The Spirit is hovering over the chaos and the threat and the confusion and the dark. God is first found, and God is consistently found in those places where God cannot possibly be. And this is where God is continually taking the disciples to the so-called other side, constantly in these stories. I remember as a young minister, I'd probably been a minister for 2 years, I got a phone call from a woman who was in our church, and I didn't know her all that well. And she said, Bobby, I'm calling because my daughter has committed suicide. She said she was involved in sex work. She was part of a suicide pact. She said, I've been contacted by one of the authorities, and they're afraid that maybe police corruption was involved. So I'm down here at the police station. My somewhat significant other, my not so significant other, frankly, is in Grenada, and I'm all alone. I've got no one else to call. Will you meet me here? I'm like barely 30. Well, that was the other side of the lake, let's just say. And I said, sure, I'm on my way. And I remember being on the train thinking, are you going to be there, God? Because this feels like the other side of the lake to me. We get there, and I remember one of the people that her daughter knew, who was one of the ones kind of as a whistleblower on this corruption, was a boxer of all things. And I just, all I can remember is the man's hands were completely gnarled. And he was talking about how not all, but some of the police in this particular institution were corrupt. And I just remember thinking, what am I doing here? And you know what? We got through this together, me and this woman. We walked through this path together, and we experienced the provision of God in that place. It was a big moment for me because I had to decide whether or not I'm going to go to the other side. And I just want to ask you that question this morning. I mean, maybe you feel like, I don't feel like I'm experiencing God in my life. I don't feel like I'm growing. I don't feel like anything's happening. Where's the power of God? And what I want to invite you to ask the question is, well, maybe it's on the other side. Like, maybe there's a place to the other side that God is inviting you to go. And by the way, the other side doesn't have to be geographically far. It could be as far as a region of your heart that you have shut and closed off. Maybe some trauma from the past, maybe something you've done, maybe something you continue to do you know you shouldn't do, maybe something you carry, I don't know, but maybe there's another side there. Maybe there's another side in your family or with your neighbor or in your workplace, but Jesus is called the man of sorrows. And so he's going to be found where sorrow is. There's a really moving testimony from, what is it called? Let Me Stand. It's Dr. King's biography. And he talks about a night in which he wanted to give up on the civil rights movement. He'd had enough death threats, and he was ready to pack it in. And it was in that night that he prayed, and he heard the voice of Jesus say, "Martin, if you continue to stand with the dispossessed, with the marginalized, with the painful, the pain, people of pain and suffering, you can be sure that I will always be standing beside you. If you stand with them, you can be sure that that's where I'm going to be." And that, he went off to preach, and within a week, his home was bombed. So the people that have, the people that experience the power of God are the people that are willing to go to the other side. That's where the power of Jesus goes. Where is the other side for you to go? Where might he be inviting you? And by the way, he's not going to force you there, and there's no reason to be kind of stupid about going to the other side either, right? Like, it's when Jesus says, let's get in the boat and go. Some of us just venture off and we get over our skis, and I'm not saying that. But I'm just saying, look around. Where do you see darkness? Where do you see pain? Where do you see sorrow? Maybe there's a chance that Jesus is inviting you into that place as a place of encounter with him. That's the places where he grows faith, hope, and love. This whole section is about maturing these disciples' faith. And maturity happens on the other side. Okay, that's the first point. Second point is, what's the extent of his power? Well, apparently, it's over all things, and it's absolutely unlimited. So let me just give you some references to Jesus' power here. Notice the power words. Jesus had commanded the impure spirit. Commanded. That's a power authority word. Verse 31, they begged Jesus not to order them to go into the abyss. The abyss was a place of judgment, ordered. Verse 32, he gave them permission. Permission is an authoritative word. And it's not just the words that get used here. It's quite extraordinary, just the power of Jesus' presence. Like, what does Jesus do in this grand act of deliverance of a man that nobody seemed to be able to calm or to heal? Well, he really, all he does is he gets out of the boat. I mean, the way this story reads is he steps onto shore and he's met by this demon-possessed man. And is the demon-possessed man kind of coming with hands flailing? No, the demon-possessed man is already falling on his feet and begging for mercy. And what has Jesus done to this point? He just got off the boat. I mean, it's really this. See, if you read these ancient sources, this is not how exorcisms go. There's always a alakazam, abracadabra moment, right? There's always a, let me roll up my sleeves and stand back, everyone. And then, fa-fum, there's something like that. And the extent of what Jesus does here is he just says, what is your name? Like, that's the great incantation of Jesus to bring this man to his knees. What's your name? Now, you might be thinking, well, maybe the guy wasn't so bad. Maybe he was just having a bad mental health day. Well, you know, it says he ran around naked. It says that he was locked with chains and he broke the chains. It says that no one could keep him under guard. It says it had been happening for a very long time to this man. And, well, you know, maybe it wasn't such a thing that he had. Well, it's like, well, what happened as soon as these demons go into the pigs? Well, this whole 2,000 herd, according to Mark, herd of pigs, rush off a cliff and drown themselves in the ocean. So that was in this man. Like, whatever made 2,000 pigs do that was what was going on in this man's soul. That this man somehow managed, I mean, in a way, this man's pretty heroic. And like, how could he have lived with this stuff as long as he did? The pigs didn't last a matter of seconds. This man had been living like this for, it seems, a long period of time, according to Luke. And so Jesus' power to just brush that aside by getting off the boat and saying, you know, what is your name? It's extraordinary, the power of Jesus. This is in a section of Jesus' authority. He calms the ocean or the seas with a word. He has this great sovereign will. Now, what's interesting about the passage is this power for the man is something that brings him joy and liberation. The man says, I'll go wherever you go. Where are you going? Can I go with you? I mean, this man, through the power of Jesus, has found freedom and joy. He's now sitting as a disciple of Jesus. Like, the power of God has made this man lean towards Jesus. But notice that the same power is what takes the crowds and the villagers and says, Jesus, get out of our village. There's a lot of little Easter egg surprises in this passage. This is one of them. Like, why do the villagers beg Jesus to go? Clearly, he can deliver people from spiritual darkness. Well, the same power that was welcomed by this man is the same power that made the villagers say, don't take another footstep on our property, like, get out of here. It reminded me a little bit of the fire of God from Leviticus. Remember the fire of God that was a welcome, that was assurance of the presence of God, and the fire of God that brought justice? And it's the same fire. It's the same power. It's not that Jesus has a dark side of power and a light side of power, and sometimes it's a dark side. No, Jesus is always the light side. He's always the life side. But see, this power for people that are oppressed, who know their need, who are ready for deliverance, who are humble, who are open, that power is liberating. That with those kind of people, when you talk about the lordship of Jesus, they say, yes, I need to be set free from these other masters in my life, and I need a Lord. Like, give me the power. I mean, step one in AA, for example, is we were powerless before our addiction, and our lives have become unmanageable. So those kinds of people, they welcome the power of God. But see, for people who are closed, for people who feel okay, for people who want their own agenda, within the same power is fearful. It says they were afraid. They ask him to leave, but it's the same power. How is that power manifesting in your life? And yet what's amazing here is, I love this too, the power and the gentleness of Jesus is all in this passage also. This man who can clearly just show up and the demons flee is the same man when they beg him to leave, he just goes. Do you notice that? Like, oh, if you don't want me to stay, I won't stay. I mean, someone with this much power, how do they typically respond when they get rejected by a crowd? Well, I'll show you, and you better watch out, and here's these threats, and here's these, you know, this scolding. There's none of that from Jesus. You know, Jonathan Edwards has a sermon about Jesus called The Excellency of Jesus Christ, talking about his power, but all his attributes. He says there's an incredible coming together of qualities in the person of Jesus that you find in no other person. He says, for example, here's someone with like unending authority and power who also says, I am gentle and I am humble in heart. If you want to know what's on the inside of me, I'm harmless. That's a coming together of things. Here's someone who is morally pure, morally righteous, utterly just, and yet boundlessly merciful and gracious to those who have failed. Like infinite righteousness, unlimited mercy coming from this same person. Here's someone who's completely sovereign and in control, and yet when asked about what he's doing, he says, whatever the Father tells me to do, I always surrender to the Father's will. Utterly sovereign, totally surrendered. Absolute power, total humility. Infinitely righteous, unlimited mercy. And this is the Jesus that we're invited to become like. This is the Jesus whose power we're invited to welcome into our lives. So we've got the destination, the other side, the hard places, the darkness. We've got the extent, unlimited authority, and yet authority governed by humility and kindness. And then lastly, I just want to point out the aim. What's so beautiful about the ending of the passage is that the ending is a reversal of everything in the beginning. You know, we sometimes talk about these little chiasms. A chiasm is where everything starts off one way and it gets turned upside down at the end. Okay? Well, that's what happens here, quite literally, with this man. Everything that describes the man at the beginning is reversed and re-engineered and turned upside down at the end of the story. So let me show you. It says in verse 29 that that this man had demons. Yeah, a man possessed with many demons in verse 27. Many demons. And then verse 35, he's now the man from whom all the demons had gone out. You see the reversal? Many demons, demons have gone out. He begins in this state of mental and psychological turmoil in verse 28. He's yelling and screaming and begging for mercy. Psychological turmoil. But then in verse 35, it says he's now in his right mind. From many demons, demons gone out, psychological turmoil in his right mind. He begins, at the beginning, he's running out of the tomb, and he's encountering Jesus in verse 27. But then at the end, he's sitting at the feet of Jesus, and he's learning from Jesus as a disciple. That's another reversal. He begins as a man running around naked. He ends as a man, it says, he's in his clothing again. He begins as a man who's been driven out into solitary wilderness places. That's what it says. But he ends as a man who's sent back home to his community. He's had a complete reversal. And what this is trying to show is, what is Jesus' power aimed at? It's aimed at holistic, comprehensive healing of the man on every possible level. On the psychological level, he's now in his right mind. On the physical level, he's now clothed. On the social level, he's now restored to his community of people. On the spiritual level, which is the level from which all the other levels take their foundation, he's restored as a disciple and follower now of Jesus, reconnected to his relationship with God. It's comprehensive healing. Luke's word for this is the word saved. So this is where you miss it in verse 36. It says, those who have seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. But the word cured there is sozo, which is the word for saved. You know, like in the gospel when it says, your faith has saved you, go in peace. Or it'll sometimes say, your faith has made you well, go in peace. Well, how do we translate it? Is it made you well or is it saved you? And the point is, to be made well is to be saved. That is the aim of the mission of Jesus, is to bring comprehensive human flourishing. Jesus in this passage is like the ultimate repo man. You remember that film, Repo Man? It's basically a guy, when people don't pay he takes back what belongs to him. Something has come under a wrong mastery and lordship, and Jesus is taking it back. Something has become fragmented, and he's reintegrating it and making it whole. And it's a comprehensive coming back together. It's a psychological reintegration of your life in your thinking. It's an emotional reintegration so that your emotions are intended and felt and directed in a way that God desires. It's physical reintegration as God intended us to be physically. It's spiritual reconnection to the very source of our life and vitality, our Creator God. It's sociological, it's relational belonging and healing and participation and community. At all levels, this man experiences salvation. And so for those of us who are more conversionists, and it's like, so here's what I'm trying to say. It's not that what this guy got from an encounter with Jesus was, hey, if you trust Jesus, you can go to heaven when you die. Now, of course he's going to go to heaven when he dies because he's trusted Jesus. But does that epitomize the nature of this encounter? See, the good news of this encounter is not just that he's going to go to heaven when he dies. The good news is that heaven is going to come, man, into your life and bring the life of heaven into your reality and reintegrate you through a long process, albeit, and make you whole again at all levels of what a human being actually is. So to the conversionist, it's like, yes, like we want reconnection with God. And yes, that is most foundational because that's the fundamental piece that when it's missing, we unravel mentally, we unravel physically, we unravel socially, we unravel psychologically. So that is the most important connection to have in your life, is this spiritual connection with God. But the intended salvation that Jesus brings is comprehensive, flourishing at all of these levels. Health, you could say. And so for those who are like, no, it's about mercy and justice and helping our communities. And yes, it is about that. Well, but it's not about the spiritual. No, actually, it is about the spiritual. And for those who are like, it's spiritual and don't focus on all these other social changes out there. It's like, no, this is a holistic salvation that Jesus is bringing to this man as a paradigm for what he wants for the world. So there's that. Let me just wrap it up here. Let me finish with this. It's very interesting. The final riddle is at the end of the passage. He tells the man who wants to go with him that he can't go. The man says, I want to be with you, Jesus. And Jesus sends him home. And it's interesting because he says no to the man who wants to be with him, but he says yes to the crowds who want him to leave. He gets back on the boat. So like, why is he saying yes to the crowds with the wrong desire and saying no to the man who seems to have the right desire? That's one of these Easter eggs. That's a little riddle in there. Remember, we began this series by saying that we're trying to live the resurrection. And that living the resurrection has to do with Jesus saying, I'll meet you in Galilee. That's where you're going to begin your Christian life with me, in Galilee. Now, the reason that was important is Galilee was where these disciples were from. That's their hometown. That's where their homes are, their families are, their workplace are. That's their ordinary life. That's where their past has been lived. That's where some of their trauma has probably happened. That's where the good things they've done has happened, the bad things they've done, the hard relationships, the good ones. Like Jesus says, we're going to begin living the resurrection in your ordinary life. And we've said that a disciple of Jesus is someone who is in this process of becoming the person that Jesus would be if he were you. So if Jesus had your physiology, if Jesus had your family of origin, if Jesus had your past, if he had your job, if he had your siblings or your parents or your children, if he had your neighbors and had your community, what would Jesus be if he were you? And that's the thing we're all trying to become. So he says to this man, I want you to go home. I want you to go to your Galilee. Like, these guys from Galilee had to go to the other side in order to experience some transformation, but this guy, he needs to go home. It's really interesting because it'd be hard for him to go home, wouldn't it? Would you want to go home if you're this guy? These people that have chained you up for years and kept you under guard and basically harassed you? Also, the people that you terrorized, you must have been so bad that you had to be chained up. You want to go back and see those people again? There must have been a lot of responsibility taking and amends making that this guy would have to make, a lot of healing. But that was a place where Jesus wanted him to go. And he would go as a witness. Verse 2, return home, tell how much God has done for you. So the man went away and told all over the town how much Jesus had done for him. I think it's verse 32. Return home, the man went. Tell how much Jesus has done. What it literally says is he went away preaching. What God has done for you has now become what Jesus has done for you. And here's the thing that I'll close with. The man went away with a story. He went home with a story. It's the word there is to narrate your life with God. It's a narration word. Tell what he's done. Share your story. And so, do you know your story? Can you narrate the events of God showing up in your chaos and darkness and in your need and meeting you there? Now, you would say, okay, that's a testimony. I'm saying, okay, yeah, be able to share your Christian testimony. But I'm talking about something more than that. I'm talking about this week. Can you share your story this week where God has turned up? Like, you know what? My spouse was frustrating me. I felt somewhat resentful and closed off. I remembered how often Jesus comes to me when I get closed off. And so I said, okay, God, I'm going to reach out once again and just say, good morning, how are you doing? Is that not narrating your story of how God's meeting with you? Or I was stressed and I was anxious and I was overwhelmed at work and I just wanted to veg out and do absolutely nothing for anybody at all. And I came to church and this pastor was preaching in front of this cross. And I remember a cross is a place where Jesus opened his arms wide and said yes to the Father and yes to humanity. And so I'm trying to keep my arms open even when I'm hurting and suffering and saying yes to what God is bringing into my life. See, that's sharing your story. And that kind of stuff is going to come up in the course of everyday life. Here's a quote. There's a tendency for us to flee from the wild silence and the wild dark, to pack up our gods and to hunker down behind city walls. In other words, not to go to the other side. To turn the gods into idols and to kowtow before them and approach their precincts only in the official robes of office. And when we are in the temples, then who will hear the voice crying in the wilderness, the other side? Who will hear the reed shaken by the wind? Friends, I encourage you this week to think about those moments where Jesus might be coming to you and kind of just knocking on the door of your heart and saying, let's go to the other side. Let's look at that thing in your life. Let's go into that relationship. Let's go into that place of ministry. And I want you to know that it's going to be okay, because that's where he's going to be. He's going to be found on the other side. Father, thank you for this text. Please help us to apply it to our hearts and lives. Jesus, we thank you that your authority is directed to the other side where it's most needed. We thank you that its bounds are limitless and yet humble and gracious. And we thank you that it means complete transformation and healing for us in this world. Amen.